I'm your host, Deacon Jonathan Stewart, and joining me is Dr. Darius Spieth. Hello, Dr. Spieth. We're going to be talking about your book, Napoleon Sorcerers. I'm already going to say it because we were already talking before the show about how you, in a way, sort of created this word. But the Napoleon Sorcerers, the Cephesians?
Yes, yeah.
Wonderful. I think it's going to be a really fascinating conversation and something that people are really going to find very interesting, because I just, unless you've read Dr. Spieth's book, even if you're really into this stuff, really into the esoteric, really into the history of the esoteric, I doubt that you've heard about this group. They're very obscure but very fascinating. So I really love unveiling something that people, even people who really love this stuff, have never heard about. I think you people are going to flip your wigs to find out about this fascinating group. But before we get to actually talk about them, I'll quickly give a plug for our Patreon. We do need your financial support to keep the show going. You can donate for as little as $1 per piece of media per month. We usually charge for about three to five pieces of media. We try to do more. We've been busy lately, but we try to do some more for free. You get the shows early. We don't give much more besides early access because we don't want to lock up content behind a paywall. But that said, you know, if there's something you want from us, let us know. You know, we're always looking for ideas about what we can give our patrons. You can do one-time donations at paypal.com/gnostic, and you can help us out in other ways that aren't financial. Telling people about the show, sharing it, putting it on your social media, telling people about it. You know, the ear to mouth still works very well, actually kind of works better than these other things. Sending people your favorite episode, pop it in an email, send it over and be like, this is the one that I love. Okay, the commercial is over, Dr. Spieth. So I know that my first question is kind of what we're going to be spending the next half hour to an hour talking about. Yeah. But I guess if you could give us sort of the elevator pitch, the summation. Can you give us a brief summation of who and what was the Sacred Order, the Cephesians?
Yes, I'll try. and it requires a lot of contextual information, I think. You know, first of all, the first thing to say is the time period. We're talking about Napoleonic France here and post-Napoleonic France. And that's very interesting because, you know, lots of historians have written so much about Napoleon and the Napoleonic age. And then there's the Restoration. There's somebody called Louis XVIII, who is a kind of relative of the royal family that was sent to the guillotine, who comes to the throne. And they are trying to turn back the clock, basically, going back to pre-revolutionary times. We also need to remember that the Cephesians, the members of this group, were what I call the generation of the French Revolution. These were people who lived through the French Revolution and its aftermath, which is Napoleon Bonaparte, right? And so the Restoration period, therefore, is politically a period about going back to the old regime. It's about going back to making Catholicism the official state religion, right? And the French Revolution was, you know, there were destructions of churches, for instance, and the Roman Catholic Church had faced a lot of problems of various sorts. So in any case, or even, you know, it's like going back to the age when the king is kind of almost, you know, put in that spot directly by divine power. So the Cephesians are really Napoleonic nostalgics, right? They are not of this regime. They were largely, or they came together mostly as a group of veterans of the Egyptian campaign, which is kind of the foundation, if you want, of the Napoleonic age, but also many other military campaigns of Napoleon Bonaparte. That is one very important component part, one background information. The other part here is theater. And with theater, I mean boulevard theaters. There is in Paris, the Temple District, which of course has its role in the history of the Knight Templars, and we can go endlessly into that, but I don't need to, and you can probably find better people to talk about it. But there is the Temple District in Paris where the Knights Templars had their headquarters, And to the north, there's the Boulevard du Temple. And one needs to know that the Boulevard du Temple was the theater mile in a Paris after the revolution, basically. With the revolution, of course, came freedom of opinion. And we oftentimes think about newspapers and the press, but freedom of opinion also meant that you can put on stage whatever you want. And there, so there's a huge blossoming of these theaters. And these theaters are boulevard theaters in the sense that it's popular theater. It's not like, you know, high-minded Racine, Corneille kind of stuff. And they have what we would say, you know, tricks that they use, you know, thunder, you know, cheap kind of tricks. And I believe very firmly that these boulevard theaters were the setting for the initiations of the Sufisians. So the group itself has its origins in the campaign of, in the Egyptian campaign of Napoleon Bonaparte, which started in 1798. It's over already by 1801. It's a complicated story. It's basically the beginning of Napoleon as a political leader as opposed to a military leader. There was a French Revolution before, and then Napoleon is appointed the general of the French troops stationed in Italy. He comes back. He's very highly regarded after that, and there's a more moderate revolutionary government in charge, and Great Britain is the kind of arch enemy, and they are about to assemble troops to invade Great Britain, and they never do this, and they decide on this completely crazy plan B, which is to invade Egypt, and Napoleon Bonaparte is put in charge of that, and it turns into a disaster, right? The, you know, he basically takes most of the French navy there, and Lord Nelson is in the Mediterranean trying to chase them down, and then they manage to disembark just outside of Aboukir, and then the British fleet finds them, shoots them to pieces. They can't get back. They're stuck in Egypt, and they march on to Cairo. They find a lot of resistance from the native population and also from a kind of warrior caste that's in charge and that's kind of has links to the Ottoman Empire, the Mamluks. And so lots of native resistance from the Mamluks originally, uprisings in Cairo that they put down. Eventually Napoleon takes the troops further up north into what would be today the Palestine territories, Israel, these kind of areas, and probably wants to march on to Constantinople or Istanbul for that matter, but he never gets there, and he's kind of repelled, limps back, and there's an outbreak of the plague, and many, many soldiers die, and eventually Napoleon Bonaparte abandons his troops in Egypt in the middle of the night, comes back to France. You would expect he's being arrested, charged, but they celebrate him as a hero, and he takes this as a cue to basically overthrow this directory government that sent him there. And so the Sufisians make the claim that they were founded in Egypt by members of Napoleon's military. And there's about half a dozen or so members who we know were active members even 20 years later, who were part of the Egyptian campaign. So it's plausible, but the group went through many changes, permutations over time. And it is a Masonic or para-Masonic organization. We are dealing here with Egyptian Rite Freemasonry, which is within Masonry, a very marginal lie, a very marginal ritual. And what is special about Egyptian Rite Freemasonry, there's still a rite that exists today, Memphis Mizraim, that follows this, but nevertheless, within Freemasonry, it's an absolute niche minority kind of thing. But what is the motivation of having an Egyptian Rite Freemasonry? Well, it's the prestige of the age of Egyptian civilization that is all about. Traditionally, Freemasonry lays claim to have originated with the deluge and the biblical story of the foundation of the earth. But then again, Egyptian monuments are older than that. And we're here, we're dealing basically with the pre-romantic romantic age. So you have a lot of, you know, stories about finding new civilizations that are older than the oldest known civilizations, and that's a cultural phenomenon of the early 19th century, and they're part of that, and one needs to understand it in this context. So in any case, by making the claim that they were initiated inside the pyramids of Egypt, you kind of plug in and connect to the to a civilization and to mysteries that are older than anything that's known before, including even the Bible for that matter. And that raises very interesting questions, because there are also natural scientists in this group. Some of them I describe as proto-Darwinists. You know, there were lots of, in the 19th century, lots of controversy over, you know, there's the Dendera seeding, for instance. That's a very interesting story. There were incredible scholarly controversies over the age of this Hellenistic monument that's in the Louvre, how old it was, and whether it proves that, you know, that there's Egyptian civilization is older than the foundation of the earth according to the Bible, and so on. So in any case, So there is evidence that indeed there were some people who were in the Egyptian campaign who were on the membership lists even during the restoration, but the vast majority of the people who we know joined much later. And in any case, that so possibly and presumably founded there, and then they keep on going until the early 1800s, and then kind of fizzle out around 1813, and they are being revived during the restoration. And the documents that we have, and that poses a little bit of a problem, there's mainly one document in the National Library in France, which is called the Golden Book of the Sufisians. Mm-hmm. And that's a document from about 1819 or thereabouts. So it dates from the restoration period, when there is a playwright named Cuvier de Trie who revives this group. And Cuvier de Trie was a veteran of the Napoleonic campaigns, not the Egyptian campaign, but veteran of the Egyptian campaigns. He wrote plays, and I mean, he wrote lots of plays, hundreds of them. He cranked them out for these boulevard theaters, and he was connected to the composers who were associated with these boulevard theaters. He was connected, obviously, with the military, and he becomes the driving force of this whole thing. And they create this illuminated manuscript, which is filled with these rebuses and images that basically you're being given to interpret as an initiate of this group in order to climb up the different degrees that they have. So that's part of the exercise, and they're all Egyptian themed, but there's all references to Hermes Trismegistus, of course. There's lots of references to Isis and, you know, speculations about Isis. Sophia, of course, is personification of wisdom, strong ties to Gnosticism, needless to say, but Sophia for the Sufisians, Sophia and Isis are basically the same, right? And they stand for this personification of female wisdom, and hence the name, the Sufisians, right? Mm.
Yeah.
So the Golden Book is this fascinating manuscript and I discovered it, I believe, at the end of the 1990s when I saw it for the first time. I'd never seen a document like that before. I spent a lot of time, and I found one article in a completely obscure Masonic journal from the 1950s there were a handful of people, Masonic archivists, who knew about the existence of this book. It's not like I rediscovered it. It was there, had an accession number, but nobody had looked at this. And so I saw this is fascinating. What is this? You know, first response was, what is this? You know, I'd never seen anything like it. And of course the riddles, you know, the rebuses there became, you know, very interesting. You know, books of Hermes Trismegistus, and you know, the whole thing about Isis, and of course Isis is veiled, and it's about the unveiling of nature, and that becomes a kind of allegory for finding the natures of nature, and what is the nature of nature, right? And so where that came from, you know, classical texts, Hellenistic texts. So that was one part of the Golden Book. Another part is stage sets, and they really look like stage sets. I think they were stage sets for the initiation itself, with all of the paraphernalia, of course, all Egyptian themed, right? And there's a membership list attached to that Golden Book. And then I found more documents as I kept on looking, some very obscure printed things. There was another manuscript that turned up in the Netherlands. In any case, I kind of got hooked on that, and I wanted to figure out what it is, basically.
Yeah. And it, was that your way in? Was stumbling across this Golden Book? Like, how did you find it? You just saw it in the archives while researching something else, or you know, I'm just so fascinated because you know, how did you find out about, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, as you just mentioned, there's only one journal article you could find, very very obscure group. Yeah.
Very good question. I, at this point in time, I was writing a dissertation on the first director of the Louvre, Vivant Denon. And there's a Masonic dictionary by Daniel Legou, which is an entry on Vivant Denon. And basically, I was only interested in the question because there's some prints that have Masonic references in the work of Vivant Denon, was also a printmaker. And so I wanted to follow up. And in this dictionary entry, it says, was a member of the Ordre Sacré des Officiants. Well, actually, he was not. He's at least, you know, I have no idea where it came from. But it's true that Vivant Denon is part of the same milieu, right? I mean, the Sufisians didn't invent Egyptian Freemasonry. There was Cagliostro, which was a famous precedent, you know, and famous adventure in the 18th century. And so if you want to look at a historical figure that is associated with the Egyptian rite, there's Cagliostro, right? And you can't get around him, and the last prisoner or the last person who died in the prisons of the Vatican. There's the legends and myths about Cagliostro are kind of endless. And of course, that's what he used to tour Europe, basically, you know, as an Egyptian rite of his own making. And he set the precedence for that, no doubt, you know, and the Sufisians come after. They were not the only ones, interestingly enough. There were miniature groups in France also that made similar claims. I think the Sufisians were the major group probably in this vein. Here again, I think there's one point that I need to make, and that is how to situate this group in the context of Freemasonry. And this is what is called, it's paramasonic in the sense that it does not fall within the general parameters of, accepted Freemasonry, so to speak. And so because of the Egyptian rite, needless to say, but it is also a system in French, you say haut grade, right, advanced degrees. In other words, you already needed to be a member of a Masonic lodge, and you needed to have passed through the three basic degrees in order to be a viable member, right? To be able to access this system. And so it's a system of advanced degrees that is based on a regular Masonic lodge, which is called the Lodge of the Frère Artiste, so the brother artist. And that was a lodge that came about, you know, basically at the end of the 18 teens and these were people who were all associated with the theater. When they call themselves the Frères Artistes, the, you know, theater and brothers of the theater, theatrical brotherhood, we're talking about people associated with these boulevard theaters. And so one thing that helped me tremendously break down who the Sulpicians were is to look at the annual membership lists of the Frères Artistes and then cross-referencing that with the Sulpician documents. Now, there were some Frères Artistes who never joined the Sulpicians for one reason or another, but you can clearly see when they appear on these lists, when they drift in and out. So, you know, it's a system of Ograd. It's you know, advanced degrees, I believe is the term in English, isn't it? Yeah. Right. And so that's an important point. It seems perhaps, again, a rather obscure point to make, but one needs to understand that basically this regular Masonic lodge was the recruiting ground for this Egyptian Rite Freemasonry. Right. And I think also the other thing is that the documents that I used, including these fantastic, well, they are colored too, by the way, you know, watercolor gouache drawings in this manuscript, which is bound in parchment and even has, you know, wonderfully illuminated a cover, all Egyptian style, right, based on actual Egyptian artifacts they had access to, mostly through prints, right, they looked at. Prince, like, even looked at Alexandre Lenoir and people like that. So in any case, the documents and most of the knowledge that we have about the Sulpicians dates from somewhere between 1819 through 1821. Cuvier de Trie dies in 1824. The Frères Artistes kind of keep on going until 1840. The golden book that I was talking about is a product of the early 1820s. So although we're talking about a Napoleonic phenomenon here, and I believe it's fair to say that it was founded during the Napoleonic age, as a matter of fact, the documents and the images that we're looking at and the texts, because there are also texts, there are very clear instructions what the initiation looks like, you know, for the aspirant degree, and then the next degree is a scholar of hieroglyphics, I believe, and the professorship of the great mysteries is the highest degrees or something like that. And so in any case, these drawings and documents, as fascinating as they are product of the Restoration period. So what we're really looking at, you know, in terms of these documents, are documents of advanced degree, high degree, paramasonic organization of the Egyptian Rite within the context of the Restoration period and Napoleonic nostalgia with a strong kind of theatrical bent.
Did they have women members? Because I know, so you know, some forms of Masonry, the dominant forms of Masonry, don't allow women in.
Absolutely, yes, and that's something that, of course, also sets them apart. There are the so-called adoption lodges for women, and they had, now, given the fact that Sophia is the female personification of Gnostic wisdom here, you know, of course, you know, there's a strong female component. Isis, of course, is female, nature is female, and let me get back to the nature thought here in just a moment, right? So they had, you know, they had female members, and they are actual depictions of rituals. There are rituals that were specifically written for women, which were a little bit different. I can read you, you know, a passage, and they're quite interesting from a textual point of view. But the interesting thing is that they, you know, you have literally, they were, you know, men and women sitting together at these get-togethers. So, you know, a very, definitely very emancipated role for women for a Masonic group of that time, right? And that was, this was not purely men's club. Now, admittedly, as it was typically the case with adoption, loge d'adoption, you know, female loges, they were oftentimes related to the male members. You know, they were husbands or daughters or something like that. But we do have their names, and sometimes it's possible to reconstruct their relationships, right? But the interesting point is, again, we have depictions of how they were seated, the seating arrangements, you know, during these rituals. Of course, they also came together for dinners and, you know, social gatherings. And you clearly see that the women are fully integrated into that. And that's also borne out in the text. And moreover, the kind of orientation of the rituals and the secret knowledge that you acquire here is also very much geared towards a female knowledge and a female conception of the world. I wanted to say one thing about nature, and I think that's very important as well. And so here we're still dealing with the aftermath of the Enlightenment, of course, and as I'm sure you and many of our listeners know, that was, you know, if you go back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you know, speculations about nature, that's very much part of the Enlightenment. And so they integrate that. And you know, in that sense, they are product of the Enlightenment, I think, and product of Enlightenment thought.
Yeah. You did mention the Napoleon's campaign to Egypt. And I understand that this sort of started a kind of Egypt mania in France. Is that true? It wasn't just the Sisyphians. It wasn't just, you know, Egyptian Freemasonry. Is this true that this was a very, this was a fad, a phenomenon? You know, they were crazy for Egypt in France at the time. Is that right?
Absolutely. And across Europe and North America, as a matter of fact, right? You know, if you take Memphis, Tennessee, you know, I mean, that was, I would have to look into, you know, when that name came about, but I think that's also late 18th, early 19th century phenomenon. So it's not confined to France, it's not confined to Europe, even for that matter. So Egyptomania was a widespread phenomenon, in especially in the early 19th century. And the Egyptian campaign of Napoleon Bonaparte triggered it, as short-lived as it was, as an actual event. One document that is absolutely amazing and had a huge impact was the so-called, in English, Napoleonic description of Egypt, the Description de l'Égypte. And Napoleon and his administration took it upon themselves after the end of the campaign to commission a monumental set of volumes containing basically prints, engravings, documenting very comprehensively the antiquities of Egypt, the monuments, the pyramids themselves, archaeological finds, and then moving on to contemporary Egypt, you know, including Islamic monuments, the contemporary cities of Egypt, geographical surveys of the country, fauna and flora. You know, it's again going back to the idea of the Enlightenment, this idea of having a vast encyclopedia of Egypt. And these volumes are also oversized. They are the size of a table. I'm not kidding you. And very, very large. And they were seen and intended at this time as a major accomplishment in science. This was seen as cutting edge scientific description of Egypt, comprehensive at that too, which of course is, you know, kind of, you know, no longer something we would subscribe to today, or how we know that knowledge is not finite. But that was the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment believed knowledge to be finite, kind of. And so this was published, and it created then for many, many years a compendium of design references of various sort, hieroglyphics galore, of course, all over the place, you know, and it was so thorough, you know, they copied all the inscriptions in the temples, and they did recreations of the temples for how they thought they looked like when they were built, including the color. They hand colored these engravings. and it became an enormous resource book for art and design, for artists, architects, and before long you have buildings, you have cemeteries, you know, there's Egyptian style cemetery near Boston, for instance, interiors, and yes, a lot of Masonic temples. There's some pretty amazing Egyptian style Masonic temples in Belgium, for instance. So in any case, yes, it set off this fashion fad for Egypt in a similar sense that the finding of the tomb of King Tutankhamun in the 1920s set off another wave of Egyptomania. It had the same effect, and of course all rendered in this very severe, almost neoclassical black and white style of these engravings. Now there is also, it's an interesting moment in Egyptology as well, because before that you had people like, well, Cagliostro obviously was not a, you know, serious figure, not a scientific figure. We can all agree on that, and people at that time agreed to that. But there was Alexandre Lenoir, for instance, who was a very interesting figure, and you know, basically saved a lot of the monuments, you know, a lot of the churches, the fragments of vandalism during the French Revolution. He saved all of these monuments, these fragments, and put them all together in a museum. But he was really taken by Egyptian speculation, and he published about that, and that was very much seen as cutting edge. And also, this is all pre-Champollion, so nobody could read hieroglyphics. And you know, Champollion's accomplishments, they are kind of contemporary with the Sufisians, but really a little bit later. So that does not figure. So the whole, what we would describe today as a scientific investigation of ancient Egypt, is in its infancy as best, or has not happened yet. And you know, the references are still Athanasius Kircher, for instance, and other texts that that are, you know, 17th, 18th century texts about Egypt, and you know, but even up to and including Alexandre Lenoir, who was, you know, a mystic, if you want, or at least the way he looked at Egypt. Now, he had never traveled there, he'd never seen the country. He was basically looking at other texts and looking at the few monuments that were available.
Yeah. You know, a really important question that perhaps I should have put earlier in my question sheet is Napoleon and his relationship to Freemasonry, or I should also maybe talk about maybe the circle around Napoleon, or the power base of Napoleon. But didn't he use, and he and his supporters kind of use Freemasonry and Masonic symbolism as a form of propaganda?
Yes, there's no doubt about that. He used Freemasonry. Even there were lots of speculations that were put into the world very deliberately by his administration that he himself was initiated during the Egyptian campaign to Freemasonry, that he was initiated in the pyramids. Of course, these are all legends, but these were legends that were very deliberately crafted. The purpose of these legends was to assure the support of Masonic lodges. The Napoleon administration understood that the political support of Freemasons was important, and therefore there were these legends being crafted about Napoleon, of course, being a Freemason himself. Whether true or not, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't want to make a judgment call, but there's whole books. There's, interestingly enough, I'm just looking at it, there's a book that came out in the first edition. It said in French title, Napoleon Freemason. And then there was a second edition, Napoleon Franc-Mason, ? Right? So in any case, that's a problem that I don't think I want to, you know, I'm not in a position to make a final judgment on whether or not it's true, and probably it's impossible to find that question. But what is certain is that these were stories, legends that were deliberately planted to assure that the Freemasons were in support of Napoleon Bonaparte, right? And that was a very important it is political. Yes, it was a matter of political support, and crafting legends such as this were also in support of Napoleon. And here again, when I said before, most of these documents are really products of the Restoration period. That's an interesting point because, you know, you're definitely not currying favors with anybody in the political leadership class during the Restoration by showing your Napoleonic support. As a matter of fact, you know, there were censorship laws during the Restoration in place, during Louis XVIII, that you could not show even a silhouette, so a shadow of a person wearing a tricorn hat on stage, because that was a sign of, you know, that was evocative of pro-Napoleonic sentiments. And so these people were amongst themselves, of course, very much Napoleonic nostalgics. That was the great moment, their moment of glory, right? And so in that sense, they were, one could almost say, an opposition force of some sort. And that's quite typical, you know, that may strike us as strange today. You had a kind of coming together of liberals, political liberals, and Napoleonic nostalgics. And keep in mind that a lot of the people who were in the military during Napoleon Bonaparte really had an axe to grind with the Restoration government. There was first, of course, Napoleon was defeated, and then the Allied forces move in, and they cut him a good deal, and he's sent to Elba, and, you know, just stay on Elba and don't come back. And then he does come back, and he kind of puts the band back together, right? Mm-hmm. And puts all of his old buddies back in these places of power. Now, initially after the defeat, they cut them a great deal. They said, you keep all of your pensions, right? Just stay out of politics, right? Everybody got a good deal. But then they did the 100 days, the 100 jours, and then Napoleon is defeated finally, right? And he's sent to St. Helena. He's out of the picture. But these people who rallied to his support the second time, they get really smacked by this because all of their pensions get reduced by 50%. So they only get half of their pension. So they were really quite mad at that, of course, right? And so there are these Napoleonic nostalgics who are kind of around, right? Now, another thing that's interesting about that from a political point of view, and I think this was one of the questions that you sent me as well, is, charitable actions. Yeah. And of course, for Freemasonry, charity is the reason for being. Maybe that's just, you know, for, you know, we want to be a charitable organization, but really it's about connections and those kind of things. But the Sulpicians took this very, very seriously. And in the Golden Book, there's even, I mean, if you wanted to rise through the ranks and, you know, become an Isiarch, right? They're all Egyptian-themed ranks and stuff like that. So if you joined the group, you basically had to adopt a poor person. And you had to care for that person until that person died. So you had, you know, this lifelong commitment to this poor person. And so, you know, they said, well, this is not just that we don't want this kind of charitable commitment to be just lip service. We take it very seriously. And Cuvilliers de Trye was very serious about that. It manifested itself also in another dimension. And that is the support of Philhellenism. And that, again, requires a lot of contextual information because during the 1820s, there's the Greek War of Independence that's going on. And Greece is still under the Ottomans. And so they're trying to break away from the Ottoman Empire and receive a lot of support from European countries, and especially a kind of educated intellectuals, artists, people of that sort. And they consider it a worthy cause. They think, you know, Greece, the cradle of civilization, and these people need to be free. And so one of the hotbeds for that becomes Vienna, for instance, for, you know, the support. There's also a lot of Greeks who stage this and support for the Greek War of Independence, who are operating from what's today Romania. And so intellectual circles in Western Europe, France, England, Germany, rally to the cause of the oppressed Greeks, and this becomes Philhellenism. And you see it in painting, you know, the Delacroix paintings, Greece on the Ruins of Missolonghi, you know, things like that. These were artworks that were painted in support of the Greek cause. And so they were fundraising. They were fundraising, you know, buying arms for the Greeks, for instance, or Lord Byron, who actually traveled to Greece and was killed there in action, supporting, you know, through his own activities, the cause of the Greeks. And so the Sulpicians were very active for the Philhellene cause in Paris at this time. Why is that politically significant? Well, the Restoration government was officially allied with the Ottoman Turks, and they supplied arms to the Ottoman Turks. And so now, you know, you have the Sulpicians and others saying, okay, if the government provides arms or sell arms to the Ottoman Turks, we need to raise funds to support the Philhellenes and send them arms so that they can battle the Turks. And so there's a lot of fundraising for the Philhellene cause going on, which at the same time positions them in opposition to the Restoration government under Louis XVIII. There's of course also political dimension, because the Restoration also meant the restoration of Catholicism to the role of the official, you know, state religion. And, you know, if you have a group like the Sulpicians, you know, there's still a lot of lingering remnants. These are all people who were raised as Catholics. You can sense that, and they can't quite get it out of their system. But nevertheless, obviously, this kind of Egyptian mysticism about Isis and Hippocrates and whatnot, you know, that's clearly not in line with the biblical teachings or, you know, the Roman Catholic Church. So, you know, they were not people who would necessarily go to mass on Sunday. So that's kind of interesting as well from that point of view. So in any case, you know, the Philhellenic cause as a charitable cause that they took up had a political dimension.
Yeah. We touched on their origins slightly, and of course they sort of have two origin stories, because as you said, they come and then they come back during the Restoration, right? Mm-hmm. But their original origin, a lot of these similar groups, like you mentioned, you know, Freemasonry claims to be thousands of years old. It's older. It's before Noah's flood, and similar paramasonic groups and other esoteric groups. They have these mythical histories. But what is the actual origin of the Sulpicians? And did they have a mythical history? And like, is the origin in the campaign? Like you mentioned that. So did they claim to discover something there, or did they claim, or is there no mythological claim? It's that we went to Egypt and we liked it so much, we wanted to bring it to France. So if you could tell me a bit about that.
Yes, I think one person they reference is Hermes Trismegistus. You know, that is, and that's of course a very, you know, thorny question. You know, it's not a real person, and you know, you have a body of Hermetic writing, and so Hermes Trismegistus is kind of, you know, I think the origin story, or at least that's what they claim. In fact, they have patched it together from various sources, including Hermetic writings, some Hermetic writings, you know, and ranging from Hermetic writings to Athanasius Kircher, and ending up with Alexandre Lenoir, right, and a whole bunch of other things. And it's a hodgepodge of these mysterious writings that came before them. But again, as I said, you know, it's not the scientific thought of Champollion, that you're dealing with here. And so, but Hermes Trismegistus, and there's actually depictions of the book, of a book on a hill inscribed with the name of Hermes Trismegistus. So that comes up time and time again as a, you know, as a textual source, perhaps. But then again, you know, Plutarch, right? The whole story of Isis and as a foundation story, legend of Egyptian history, with the story of Isis and Osiris and so on. So they were certainly avid readers of classical texts, of Greek texts. Sometimes Diodorus of Sicily comes up, you know, it's a hodgepodge of different textual references, and they put them together in a sometimes haphazard way to create their own belief structures. But again, I think, you know, the figure of Isis looms very large. You know, that's fair to say. Perhaps I can, you know, if I find it, you know, maybe I'll find the text quickly here about the kind of assignment, basically, that one needs to resolve for the grand the professorship of the grand mysteries. So if I can find it here very quickly. So in any case, you know, it says, for instance, in order to achieve the professorship of the grand mysteries, have studied in part of comprehensively natural history in its three ages, morals, philosophy, history, geology, geography, mathematics, physics, medicine, anatomy, philology, astronomy. But while overflowing with human knowledge, the initiate will attach himself to one of the sciences, following his taste, and deepen it enough eventually to become a professor. You know, that they almost, you know, it becomes almost a kind of university, right? A structure. But let me just see here. In any case, it's basically at the end you're being asked to speculate about nature, you know, and to engage in that, and it's almost like writing an essay about that question. And the interesting thing is there that we have you know, natural scientists such as Faye, who wrote treatises that remind us of kind of you know, Darwinism or neo-Darwinism even. So there you go, right?
I think for modern people, that this sort of combination of ancient Egyptian gods and esoteric mysticism with Enlightenment values seems strange, maybe, to modern people. But of course, this was very common at the time. There's other paramasonic groups doing it, and they are sort of viewing it as all one thing, right? Like to know nature is to also know religion, right? To know science is to know the mind of God. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So they take it very seriously. So science is kind of you know, linked to mysteries and initiation, right? And also, you know, to psychological states. The psychology of this is very, very interesting, because it's also the rituals are designed to instill fear as well, right? You know, that's of course to some extent true of you know, other Masonic rituals as well, you know, they're very, very interesting kind of passages here about this kind of psychological aspect of it that you need to go through, right, and that you learn something from that about yourself and the world that you're inhabiting.
Well, again, maybe sort of a complicated question, but can you tell us a little bit about their beliefs and their teachings? You know, what is it that they sort of instilled in people, wanted people to know? What are the mystical and religious teachings that are in the Golden Book? Like, did you have to become an ISIS worshiper? Were you out sacrificing bulls to ISIS? Like, how did it sort of, like, you know, what is it that they want people to believe?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a good, you know, it's a little bit of a longer passage here, but I think it's quite vivid. So I'm going to read you, and this is my translation. You know, that is, let me just see, you know, I believe this is the initiation to the scholar of hieroglyphics, right? And so it reads, quote, "A cave illuminated by lamp affixed to the wall. As soon as the recipient or the initiate has entered, the stone-cut door shuts with a shattering noise, and he finds himself locked in. On a rock, tablets have been left that contain the following words: Neophyte, you entered the pyramid by your own free will, and you will finish your life in it unless you find the sanctuary of truth. Search, but watch out. The vault is narrow, treacherous, and difficult. Water, air, and fire, all the elements you conjured, will block your passage. If you do not have the courage to face these perils, remain here where you're in safety. Instead of triumphing in the eyes of the world, live unspectacularly in solitude. What glory is to the eagle who challenges the air to behold nature's king of stars," that's the sun, of course. "Nourishment is to the owl who avoids the light of the sun by hiding itself in the hole of a solitary and rotting tree. Make your choice, but consider that you need to conquer alone, without counsel, by dint of your spirit, by your own courage, by your prudence. Think well. Three slaps with your hand of equal length and the word Hermes enunciated three times with a high voice will be the signal of your resolution and will open the door for you to the secret and dangerous exit passage where you need to crawl in order to elevate yourself. After the recipient has given the signal," clapping with his hands, the first underground conduit will be uncovered. He enters by bending over. Soon the canal will become narrower. The neophyte drags himself on his hands and knees, sometimes going uphill, sometimes going downhill. During this difficult crawl, the sound of rumbling boulders in the lateral conduits inspires fear in his soul, and an odious stench troubles his senses of smell. One by one, he experiences the tests of the three elements, and amidst the fourth test, he arrives at the well, at the bottom of which is truth. He climbs into the well by finding holes in the openings of the decaying walls, and at the bottom of the gaping mouth encounters a unique access opened by his pushing a protruding block that activates an unlocking mechanism. He finds himself in the sanctuary of fantastic illusions. Typhoon and his terrible following block the passage by vomiting fire and flames. The neophyte cannot dissipate the magic spell, but by pronouncing with a raised voice all the sacred words of the previous classes of initiation. Nuzibi, Zuri, Ziz, Kaiser, Demeter, Seri, Horus. Finally, the phantoms vanish completely upon the recipients, pronouncing the name Hermes last. After this triumph, he catches his breath for a moment as the netherworld recedes to obscurity. The voice shouts, "Get rest," and a chair approaches the recipient. Keep in mind, this is probably on stage and they are using these stage tricks, right?
Yeah.
So, and a chair approaches the recipient. He sits down. Immediately, invisible hands cover his eyes. A swift chariot carries him away and thunder accompanies his course. When the chariot stops, the neophyte hears a vague melody. He inhales an air embalmed with perfumes, and remote voices resound with the opening hymn of the mysteries. In vain, demiurge, you veil your essence, etc. That really exists. I actually found the musical scores and the texts to that. There is Sufisian music, and the scores have survived in the Bibliothèque Nationale, in the Department of Music. At the end of the song, the blindfold falls, and he finds himself on a flower throne, facing the assembled heads of the order in the Temple of Wisdom, all Sufisien and Sufisien, male and female initiates, decked out in their splendid costumes, surround him and congratulate him. Right. And so that's interestingly enough, there's a female version. Would you like to, would you care for the female version as well?
Yes,
Or
please. Yeah.
One leads the female neophyte to the cabinet. One gives her the golden key while telling her that it is the one that opens the little door. But open it, she is not allowed to do. She's then left alone. Soon one will know whether her curiosity leads her to use the key. One does everything to let her curiosity gain the upper hand, whether by means of the secret cabinet or by sending in a female friend who convinces her to use this key, the key, or by a remote voice, or by having a male Cephisian talk to her through the closed door, urging her to use the key. If she insists on her refusal to open the secret door, two ladies will enter the cabinet. They congratulate her on her discretion and tell her that she will be given a prize. They'll blindfold her and take her to the rolling chariot. Otherwise, if she opens the door, there issues forth with great noise a winged monster. Two masked male members of the aspirant degree appear. They dress her down with reproaches over her perjury, put her in chains, cover her eyes, and spirit her away with the same chariot. In either case, the reception continues like the one for the man, but one does not ask her to explain the hieroglyphics and maxims to the latter. One modifies them by making them sweeter, by making them more likable and spiritual. Immediately after this explanation, one accuses the female recipient of a mistake. One demands that she show her courage to punish herself if she's guilty, or to tolerate her punishment if she thinks her conscience to be beyond reproach. As soon as she is promised to do so, one presents her with a dagger so that she may slash herself, but hardly has she touched the hilt, the blade changes into a bouquet of flowers. So, in any case, you know, these are the tests.
These are so amazing, and I can't imagine, what when you're talking about some of the psychology, the psychological changes that must have happened within people to go through such elaborate rituals. And as you've pointed out, these were very the tricks, the special effects were very impressive, probably by the standards of the time, but also by today's standards, right? You would have these theater professionals and these very elaborate theaters of all these sets. There wasn't movies, right? So this is where people were getting their grand huge entertainment. So and some of these Bolivar plays, some of these melodramas, right? They had these volcanoes erupting on stage and
It was
waterfalls and
new at that time, right? It was relatively new. We would describe it today as a cheap trick, right? But it was pretty new at that time. And you mentioned a very important word here, and that is entertainment. This was also entertainment, I think. Yes, it was serious. It had a deeper philosophical quest for truth and knowing oneself, in many ways it had, of course, also a relationship, of course, to Greek philosophy, to very deep-seated questions. Although when we talk about ancient Greece, we're talking more often than not about the Hellenistic world, as opposed to the world of Plato. So in any case, but it's absolutely true that this was also entertainment. I think also the detail that, like this story with the dagger that turns into a bouquet of flowers, that's so specific, I think, that one, clearly has to assume that this was real, that a lot of it has this specificity. But then again, there's also more advanced intellectual things like writing these essays, where it's really about the creation, and life, why is there life and how did it come about? Basically, you had to write for the highest degree, you had to write an essay. What do you believe is the origin of life on Earth? How did it come about? And that's, of course, a question that's linked to nature, right?
Well, and you mentioned know, there's that Heraclitus quote, right? Nature veils herself. Yes. So that's why Isis, as you mentioned in her iconography, is shown veiled. And then the ancient Isis worshippers, the Hellenistic Isis worshippers, right? They had the experience of Isis removing the veil, which was sort of their enlightenment's prime initiatory experience. So does Isis sort of become like their main symbol, because they're trying to understand everything holistically, right? To lift up the veil. So is that one of the things that Isis really means to them?
Yes, I think, you know, Isis is basically a figure also of self-knowledge, mm-hmm. You know, knowledge of about the world, right? And you know, there we go, you know, I think that's absolutely right. You know, that's the deeper meaning of Isis. You know, it's the figure of nature, but it has also deep-reaching philosophical, you know, implications, and ultimately implications about the nature of knowledge, the nature of nature, and the nature of being.
Yeah. Now, what is it about the art and her visual language that grabbed you? Because we didn't talk about your background, right? But you're an art scholar, correct?
I'm an art historian, yes.
Art historian, yeah.
I'm an art historian.
So you know a lot about art. You look at a lot of art. You look at a lot of French art, because you mentioned you were doing that work on the Louvre. Mm-hmm. So what is it that grabbed you about their art? And I know, again, this is perhaps a subjective question, but is it quote unquote good art, whatever that means, in your opinion?
That's an interesting question. Well, you know, in terms of, well, first of all, we are talking here about the heydays of academic art, Jacques-Louis David and so on. So it's clearly not up to these standards. I do believe that a lot of the drawings were done by somebody who possibly passed briefly through the studio of Jacques-Louis David, named Ponce Camus, because he was keeper of the seals. And that also includes the Livre d'Or, the Golden Book, right? So in any case, yes, but there is a naive touch to these illustrations, you know, also when it comes to perspective or, you know, issues of human anatomy, it's not always up to snuff, you know, but that may have been deliberate as well. I think that's not outside of the realm of possibilities. Keep in mind also that these documents were conceived as working materials. They were not created to be masterworks to be shown in a museum. This was a book that was, you know, handed to people. And, you know, here is this drawing, although they referred to it, they called it all hieroglyphics and whatnot, but they're really drawings. And interpret that for us if you want to get ahead, go ahead and, you know, rise through the ranks of this association. So... So in any case, that's and so one needs to think of it as well as a prop. The book itself was part of the prop. It was part of the initiation ceremonies. It was handled during the initiation ceremonies in various forms. So I think it belongs more to the largely lost world of all of these Sufusion props, and they did have props, and the props played a very important role.
Yeah. And when you said as part of their, you know, the initiations, right, they went for these different degrees, and as part of passing the degree, it wasn't just a ritual. They would pass you the book, they would point to an image, and you would have to give an explanation of that image. Is the explanation predetermined? Is there a correct interpretation that the initiated has to give, or if they are able, or is it that they're able to give an interpretation that perhaps is completely original, but is using, you know, the knowledge that they've studied? It's interesting. It seems to connect to the images. Which was it in that case?
That's a great question. Fantastic. Very good. One needs to differentiate, I think. First of all, you know, in Freemasonry, you have, like, you know, in Catholicism or Christianity, you have catechism, as a matter of fact, and there are certain standard questions that one needs to know and one needs to answer. And there are such catechisms for the Sulpicians, in fact. They do exist, but they are being used basically for the new initiates, okay? And as they rise through the ranks, and especially as they get to the scholar of hieroglyphics and then professorship of the grand mysteries, it is really something where you need to form your own opinion, you know, where you need to synthesize information and where the answers are open-ended, right? And I can read you this little passage here. This is for the class 2 degree in arts and sciences of the professorship of the grand mysteries. And the initiate had to kind of grapple with the following question, and I'm going to read it. And again, it's from the Golden Book. First hypothesis to be developed from the hyssop, that is the herb to be used in mosaic rites of purification, to the oak, from the ant to the elephant, nature seems to strive to march from perfection to perfection. Is not the single stem of the polyp the first sketch, the primordial type of marvelous interior of man, at once the most complex and the most perfect being? Why did perfection stop at this point? Was the creator incapable? That would be impossible if man is the last echelon of the sublunar beings. Does the ladder end with man? Why does it not lead step by step from the good to the better by rendering matter diaphanous and striving towards aerial intelligence up to the level of pure spirit, the perfect point of its immersion in the source of life, of mixing and aggregation of divine essence, of the reunion of the soul of all things with nature? Man always hopes, this vague hope, is it not the word for the enigma of death? So these are things one should speculate about, and I think there's interesting things embedded. These are kind of rhetorical questions to some extent, of course, and but you know, there's also a developmental story here, and I interpret it also as embedded in it almost a Darwinian theory of, you know, an evolutionary theory, but it's mixed in with other things. You know, it's the Masonic story of self-perfection that comes across very strongly. It's also the grappling with mortality. And of course, again, back to the issue then, what is nature ultimately?
Well, unfortunately, we have to start wrapping up, and you know, there's tons more questions I could ask, but I guess an important one to end the show with is what happened to them.
Well, they fizzled out. It's very funny, and I very much got the impression that Cuvier de Trie, and I actually found his grave. It's on the Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. It can still be visited, and it's not to be missed. It's a miniature pyramid, as a matter of fact, as his gravestone. I very much had the impression that this kind of second wave of Sulpicians, and mind you, there's very little that is hardly anything that's left of the first Sulpicians. I think they did exist. I think they were real. But, you know, again, you know, it's by chance even that this Golden Book exists, you know, that could have gotten lost as well. But I have the impression that Cuvier de Trie really held this group together. And I also think he was quite an eccentric. He left, again, a huge body of plays that nobody reads today, you know, but you go to the library of the National, the catalog of the National Library in Paris, and you can pull up something like 150 or so plays, and I found some that are not even in that catalog. And I read many of them. I did not read all of them, but it gives you a good sense of, you know, who this person was. And you also find similar descriptions of what's happening behind stage, which is similar kind of quote, what I would call tricks, you know, special effects, if you want. So in any case, it has a similar structure. in that sense. But I did have the impression very much that it all hinged upon him, and he held these people together. And he died in 1824. There was a successor, a guy named Fouché, who was from the south of France, and he was in the Napoleonic administration. He was really bureaucrat. I believe he was also, you know, with the police or something. And, you know, it seems to fizzle out. The Préartistes keep on going longer, but there's fewer and fewer evidence once you get into the 1830s in particular, fewer and fewer evidence that the Sulpicians are still going on. So I think really Cuvier de Trie was a driving force, and because he had all of these contacts, you know, other playwrights, and keep in mind these boulevard theaters, there were lots of people employed there. So he wrote the plays, but there were actors, there were musicians, people who created these stages. Ponce Camus, the artist I referred to, was presumably also somebody who did stage sets there. So, you know, he had access, he had a large social circle, and he used this social circle to keep these people together. And then he died in 1824, and they keep it going for a little bit, but I think it was really his charisma that held it together.
Yeah. Well, the name of the book is Napoleon's Sorcerers, the Sulpicians. I highly recommend that you read it, buy a copy, buy 10, buy one for all of your friends. And some people will be watching this on YouTube, some people will be listening to it as a podcast, but I've thrown up where people can find you, your LSU page. But if people want to contact you, know more about your work, that's where they should go. Is that right?
That's okay.
Yeah, I'll also put that in for those listening. I'll put the link in the show notes, and it'll also be in the show notes on YouTube. So definitely check out Dr. Speed's page. Okay, wow. I guess it's time to wrap up. I wish we could go longer. There's so much more to talk about, but it's been really awesome. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, John. True pleasure being on the program. And yes, it's a huge topic. And thank you very much for kind of giving me the time to develop all of these things, and you know, yes, thank you very much. Looking forward to continuing the conversation sometime in the future.
Anytime. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye now. Good.